This podcast is brought to you by Vivino. Discover and buy wines wherever you are. Visit vivino.com/heritage to stock up.
Hi, I'm Moxie Rosenbloom. My dad, Harry Rosenbloom, hosts Feast Your Ears on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, HRN is having a summer membership drive. Becoming a member is so easy, and you'll help support shows like my dad's. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of the latest episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We're counting down the days to the 4th of July, so this week's theme is independence. After all, we're an independent food radio station.
HRN is a labor of love. Staff, hosts, and listeners all share the belief that storytelling can change the world, one bite or sound bite at a time.
We take a moment to ponder our founding mothers and fathers, specifically what they were drinking during the Revolutionary War.
Rum in various combinations with beer and cider would be the order of the day.
We highlight a story of self-sufficiency on the island of Vieques, Puerto Rico.
The biggest thing we did was to start a lot of fermented vegetables because we knew the first thing to go would be refrigerator trucks coming to the island.
And we examine the challenges facing independent grocery stores across the U.S.
The struggle is real, but the future looks bright.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, available at heritageradionetwork.org and wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coral Lee. Chef/radio host Jenny Dorsey's culinary mission is grand, cooking food and creating environments that are often deliberately uncomfortable, in an attempt to change the world with her art. She's working to expose the banal routine and social norms we find ourselves in, and believing in food's capacity for storytelling and genuine interaction, even uses augmented and virtual reality to render her food all the more impactful. A fellow Heritage Radio Network host, Jenny has cooked at Aterra and Atelier Cren, worked in fashion, pursued an MBA, recently wrote a cookbook, was chopped by Ted Allen, and she even makes ceramics as a side passion. Thanks so much for joining me today, Jenny.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with that, your crazy journey to food. How did you go from fashion to business school to culinary school to ceramics, all of it?
Yeah, I mean, even when I was young, you know, I was always an eater. I loved food. But growing up in a very traditional Chinese family, that was not an option. That was not, like, it was so far from an option. I never considered it. Both my parents are scientists. And I just remember them telling, you know, don't go into science because you won't make any money. Go into business. And so that was always my thing, like, what part of business should I go into? And when I was 15, 16 or something, I remember watching Queer as Folk, which was one of my favorite TV shows. Mm-hmm. And the main protagonist on that show is an advertising exec. So I decided I would be a marketing major in college, which it totally was like, I don't know where that came from. You know, clearly it was baseless. Realized I didn't really like marketing. Ended up switching to finance. Went into management consulting, essentially through like an accidental array of things, and realized I don't like any of what I'm doing. I kind of liked fashion, I think, for the fact that it sounded cool. And so I moved from management consulting into consulting with fashion, specifically at the company I was at. And I was really lulled into complacency there because it seemed so glamorous what I was doing. I was working at all these fashion labels. I was getting big discounts on their clothes, which ironically, even if you get a 60% discount, you are still paying a lot of money for like a $1,000 dress. If you just think about that, like that was more than I could afford. There was one month I think I netted a negative because I spent so much money on clothes.
But you looked great.
But I guess I thought I looked great. I was also a little bit of like a binge eating problem because I was like obsessed with my weight, like lots of problems essentially. And at some point realized if I don't do something for myself, I'm going to wake up and I'm going to feel bitter and resentful every day. Kind of like how I was feeling every day already. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to do. And instead of actually taking like a courageous step, which I think some places have painted my journey more as, I was like, you know what? I'm going to apply to business school for my MBA. And that way I can just take a little break from all the shit that's going on right now. And then I can continue going back into fashion and making my money and whatever. So I applied to business school, got in. I essentially had a year off before I was supposed to be working. But I quit my job and went to culinary school and thought, hey, like I'll just take a creative sabbatical and call it a day. And then
before business school.
Huh. I graduated culinary school 3 days before I started at Columbia. And I knew right away, like going back into the grind, I was like, this is not for me. I have to figure something else out. Like my heart's just not in it anymore. And I can't, you know, there was like this quote from somewhere that's like, most people die at 25, but aren't buried until they're 75. Oof. And I was like, I don't want to be that person. Cause I think that's where I'm going, you know? So yeah, I've been trying to figure it out ever since, still figuring it out.
Mm-hmm. So, but during culinary school, were you ever thinking, I feel like it's hard to fully immerse yourself in culinary school with that mindset because you were just thinking like, oh, it's okay. I'll just return to real life with business school. But did you feel like you learned a lot about yourself in culinary school and really became, I don't know, the person you were meant to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely was a disconnect because, you know, all my culinary classmates were talking about getting jobs or they had these different aspirations. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go to business school and whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think the big thing that I learned there is I've always surrounded myself with people like me, you know, who are trying to climb the ladder, pursue the rat race or whatnot. And the people that I met in culinary school just came from such different backgrounds with very different types of quote unquote resumes, as you would call it, different walks of life, different ages. Some people had been in the Navy, some people had kids, some people like had just different perspectives on life that made me realize I was in a bubble and I never acknowledged or entertained the fact that I had lived a really sheltered and privileged life. The fact that I can just casually take some time off. My parents were essentially paying for me to live in New York so I could go to culinary school and burn through my savings. Mm-hmm. Like that's so much privilege in one sentence and I didn't even see it. And they really helped me learn more about myself and be a little bit more appreciative of how difficult and different everyone's lives are.
Mm-hmm. So after culinary school, you decide to drop out of Columbia. And so what was your glorious return to the culinary world? Because now you have like the Wednesdays pop up and you're doing like, yeah, what are you doing right now? And how did you get here from there?
After I left, I was not glorious at all. I promise. It was just like random jobs, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. So for a while I was a barista because I wanted to learn more about coffee. I basically was like, if I take a bunch of internships, I can learn and then I could make a little bit of money and then maybe figure something out along the way of what I did like or didn't like. I did PR for a little while. I hated that. I sold juice to Silicon Valley VCs for a while, like literally door to door juice salesman peddling green juice. That was interesting. My husband and I were both out in San Francisco and he was working at a big startup and I was like, oh yeah, you know, I was like in like Sequoia Capital's office today. And he was like, what? Doing what? Selling them juice. like all these people like dreaming to be in their office. Anyway, so I was a host for a while. Obviously worked in restaurants as well. I feel like I just gained a lot of life experiences on how people treat each other in the food industry. In the food industry to each other, as well as people outside the food industry treat people in the food industry, and started like ruminating on thoughts of like what some of these problems that I might want to tackle in the future, even though that didn't really I didn't really like fully realize that for years down the line. What I actually ended up doing was taking a full-time job at Le Pain Quotidien. They're a boulangerie with worldwide locations, and doing R&D and menu research and development for them. So I kind of used that to start an independent consulting business where I did essentially that exact thing for all different brands and businesses across the US. And that was super boring. it was good for a while because there's always like that initial like, oh, I'm learning, this is exciting, new menu. And at some point, the reality was, like, the places that will pay you the most money wants the most boring menu. And it just felt like I was, like, wasting my talent and wasting my time. So I wanted to do something else, but I didn't know what that was. And through that came Wednesdays, which was this creative outlet for me. Like, if there's no pressure to really make money, I want to host these events that mean something. Like, what kind of food do I want to put out there? What kind of experience do I want people to have at these events? How do I want them to interact? Because my co-founder, who's also now my husband, one of the things that we always talked about, we met in business school, was people don't open up with each other. People talk about the same things every day. The subway, or the weather is a good one, or whatever stupid thing that happened to them at work. But, like, what about the real things? People get so uncomfortable when you start talking about, you know, my father-in-law was diagnosed with cancer and just beat that. Like, there is something, you know, like, we don't need to spend 30 minutes on it maybe, but now you know something about me and we can talk about that. Like, and just how do you create a space where people feel comfortable doing that? Mm-hmm. How do you create a menu and food, and my husband does the drinks, in a way that people feel like they're safe? So that's the spirit of Wednesdays, and we've been able to successfully carry that through for the last 4.5 years.
Amazing.
Yeah. And then I guess the main other thing I do, which started last year, was doing more virtual reality, augmented reality. I became really interested in it randomly one day at acupuncture. I, like, woke up and was like, this is what I have to do.
Spooky.
Yeah. And I went home and I was like, this is what I'm going to do. And my husband's like, I support you. I don't know what you're talking about. So supportive. And I've been trying to figure it out ever since. And I think finally I have events coming up that I think where adding AR, VR to food makes sense, because I didn't want it to be like, there's a lot of kitschy shit out there mm-hmm. that has food and tech. There's the most expensive restaurant in the world is in Ibiza, and they do this like VR segment, they do like AR stuff, and it's all just like fanfare and EDM and, you know, and I don't want that. So trying to figure out how to do it in like an artful way. We can talk about like some of the stuff I have coming up, but yeah, I'm still trying to find that balance.
Yeah, let's start with Wednesdays. So what is that space like? Is there like a regular, is it like a restaurant, like a regular menu, or is it, how are you able to kind of keep your narrative,
yeah.
if that makes sense, while managing like the business side?
One of the challenges that we move where the events are hosted, so we don't have total control over the space. Mm-hmm. We've popped up in everything from, when we first started, it was out of our one bedroom, like in Chelsea, which as you can imagine was quite small. but we've popped up in like old warehouses. We popped up inside office buildings. Our last one was inside the restaurant space at Urban Outfitters in Williamsburg, not too far from here. And it's a fully fleshed out restaurant on the second floor, but inside a clothing shop. So kind of like a weird vibe too. And we do our best in terms of trying to make the space immersive. So there's things that bring you around the space. We're not totally serious all the time. So there's things like hanging terrariums that had bugs in them. Mm-hmm. And you would eat that and you would like cut it from the ceiling. So there's like something to get you to a far corner. Or there was a make your own like Negroni station. So people had something to do and they could talk to each other, something to help break the ice. But I think the main thing in terms of setting up the space for success and setting up the event for success is that we prime the audience before they come with questions on what we expect them to be. Not so much, you have to talk about this, but this is the level of vulnerability we're asking for, and we're mm-hmm. upfront about that. So questions like, you know, what is your biggest failure and how has that motivated you? You're required to send something in, and if you send in a bad answer, we'll just kick your ticket out.
Wait, what's a bad answer?
No, I have
like
never
failed.
I've literally never failed. That is an answer we've received.
Oh.
And I'm like, wow, I don't, you're delusional or you're a genius. I'm not sure which one.
Right.
So yeah, like I think some people have seen the questions and they don't come, and that's okay because they're not our target audience. We're lucky that we have enough people who are interested, engaged, that we sell out every time and we have a wait list. So, you know, I know that this is something people want for their lives, even though sometimes people are afraid to, you know, come up and just announce it all the time.
Mm-hmm. So for example, with this failure question, people are prompted to think about this, and then are they also prompted to discuss it at the event? So how how does food and drink kind of act as this like lubricant to talking about that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So when after everyone answers with their questions, we actually, or with their answers, we take those answers and we integrate them into the event in different ways. So for instance, one of the questions is, are you in the job that you want? And if not, how are you getting there? Or what are you doing to get there? Which is, I think, pretty direct. Mm-hmm. So like, we get pretty interesting answers from that one. And instead of having everyone's name card, like your, you know, the name tag to notify you of where your seat is, it's the answer to that question. Oh. So people, as they're trying to find their seat, are inevitably reading other people's answers. Oh, okay. And kind of like, sometimes that prompts discussion. I like to think of it as we provide a toolkit. And if you want to take those tools and use it to talk to other people, you can. If they're adults, you can't force them into a conversation or else awkward. But there's little pieces everywhere. So that's one thing that's there. Another answer to one of the questions is on the back of the menu. So we do a seat switch in the middle and everybody reads that answer and goes off and kind of mingles. Mm. And with the food and drink, all the food has a pretty specific title, and I'll come out and talk about it. So one of the food things that I've had recently, it's called Fancy because it's French, and talking about the values and the worth that we assign to certain cultures or certain people, certain food, before we really know anything about them. No knocks on French food, but I think it's enjoyed a relative feel of royalty in the gastronomy world, and it's totally baseless, you know. Mm-hmm. So digging into that and setting that stage with the food and every piece of the ingredients and the process of it is symbolic, and prompting people to kind of talk about it. And I like to think that I'm not being prescriptive, I'm just asking questions, and people will think about those questions and talk to their neighbor about it.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, the reason I found your work is I was just clicking through Instagram, the rabbit hole, and I came across your page, and it's just all these stunning plates, right? Like perfect little sauce dots, yeah. Perfect little octopus tentacles. I'm like, oh, that's a berry. No, it's an octopus. It's just so stunning. And it kind of, and you also have these huge captions that, mm-hmm. you know, show that there's really always a story behind the dish. And that really reminded me of museum culture, right? There's like the wall text and there's the image or whatever you're supposed to contemplate. And was that reference intended?
Yeah. I definitely think that, so Instagram's caption limit is 2,200 characters that I know very familiar. and I think that people squander it. People squander it on these dumb posts that are like, look at me, I have sunglasses on and I'm at the beach, which is fine. Like, that's fine if, you know, your Instagram, like, account is personal and you're doing your thing. But there's so many influential people, and I don't consider myself really one of them, but people who have huge followings that are not like doing anything with their Instagram. Or maybe they're selling you a lifestyle that you can never have, that you can aspire to have, mm-hmm. but you're never going to afford that yacht. You're never going to afford that swimsuit. You don't have that body. So like, why don't we use that space to talk about something more important? Or at least I think it's more important, I guess, in my own biased view. People, things that are painful sometimes, or things that are just people are actually experiencing on a day to day.
Yeah, there's this one fashion blogger I follow, and she has like, I think, over maybe a million followers.
Oh my gosh.
And she's probably like 16 or something, wears like Gucci, and then every other caption is, I don't know what to caption this. Like a million likes. I'm just like, what the heck? I mean, it's cool, but why?
Yeah. Exactly. It's like, it feels, I mean, good for her, you know, and she's built a brand, but it's like, it's thoughtless. Like, I don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So can you talk about the process of compiling one of these posts? Is it like something that you've already cooked for Wednesdays, or something you've cooked for the Studio ATAO, right? Mm-hmm. Is that what it is? Or is this like you are cooking for the Instagram?
It's a mix. I think so the upcoming event, it's a collaboration between Wednesdays and then my studio. It's called Studio Tao. It's a nonprofit that does all my AR/VR work, and it's called Asian in America. So it's about the Asian American identity. And I've had that idea for a while, and I write as well. So I had been writing these little like miniature personal essays on different facets of my memories of the life that is being Asian American. One of the things that, you know, always comes back to me is feeling like people can judge your culture but you can never judge your culture, you know, this perpetual bystander effect, or feeling like...
Wait, can you break that down?
Yeah.
That's really important.
I think that's one of the big things that I don't understand about, but I see and feel very acutely with other minorities is... As a minority, I think Trevor Noah said this really well. As a minority, you don't get to be an individual. Everyone else's actions reflects on you. Mm-hmm. And the majority gets to judge those actions. But you never get to say, like, that's not me, or that's, you know, you're not understanding the context of that. I talk about this a little bit in one of my dishes about dog food. Mm-hmm. As a Chinese person, I've heard so many times this, like, insults about, like, oh, well, Chinese people eat dogs. And some Chinese people do eat dogs. And you know what? They're perfectly justified to eat those dogs because they're literally starving. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing else to eat. And we don't get to judge with our standard of living what they get to do with their lives. But it's, you know, now in the States, that context is lost. And other people get to opine on this little piece of your culture. But it, you can't really respond to it ever. You, like, don't have a voice in that. And I've dubbed it the perpetual bystander, always feeling like you just have to receive the judgment. And now that Asian food is cool, it's cool to not eat dogs, but eat things like stinky tofu, or it's cool to eat bugs, or it's cool to whatever. But that wasn't the case when I was in seventh grade and I was eating in the bathroom because everybody was like, ugh, that stuff is so gross. You know?
I've totally done that too.
Yeah. Or like you get garlic chives and they smell like farts.
Mom, no.
Not that one. Yeah. And I get that. And it's like such a painful, complicated memory. And like it's worth talking about. Mm-hmm. And I want to express that through my food. And sometimes it's uncomfortable because there are people that have eaten my food who was the bully. Like they don't have to tell me that, but you can just tell. Like, and that's okay. Like everyone goes through puberty in different ways. But that's a part of them, and that's something to acknowledge and understand, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I was supposed to start. I was just so excited to start the show, but I'm trying this new thing, which is opening each episode with the question, where are you from? Which, living in New York, I thought I would never be asked that question again, but it's happened recently, and it was right, it's time to reappropriate this question. So I'm going to start this over. Where are you from?
So now, it's funny that you asked that, because it's also... I think what's so important about that question is who is asking it to you.
Yes.
Like being another Asian person that you're asking me from, I'm like, oh, like I'm from Shanghai and mm-hmm. my mom's from Shanghai. My dad's from Shaanxi and they moved to New York when I was really little. So I moved to New York when I was 3.5. And then but I grew up in Seattle and went to college in Seattle. And I knew that Seattle West Coast chill life is not for me. So I came back to New York and I've been here pretty much ever since. But depending on the context of when I'm asked that question, I was recently asked this actually at a wedding in Kansas City. Like literally this guy was like spittooning on me, like, where are you from? And I was like, oh, I'm from New York. Mm-hmm. And he's like, but where are you from? Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I'm from Seattle. And then I just kept at it, you know? And it's like it's this weird thing of you almost don't want to say where you're actually from because you don't want to give them the answer they want. Or the answer that they're looking for, which is, oh, I'm from China. And they're like, oh, yes. As if suddenly they understand something about you that they didn't before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had the editor-in-chief of Munchies on last week. Mm-hmm. And she put it really interestingly, which is like, if you ask me the first time, I say I'm from New York. If you ask me the second time, I say I'm from Michigan, which is like your Seattle answer. The third time is like, you're asking me because I don't look like you.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, totally like the layers. Anyway, so now that we've done the introduction, let's go back to Studio Tao. So how have you been cooking with VR and AR in your work?
Yeah, so...
In a way that's like not kitschy or fanfare, which I think is really hard to do.
Especially with the new technology, especially when there's all the kitschy stuff gets all the press. So what I'm doing for this Asian in America event is I have three... It's going to be a 6-course meal, so everyone gets fed a little bit more. But the initial story is a 3-course meal, and every course is pretty symbolic. It's like it follows like an appetizer, entree, dessert sort of format. And I have a tilt brush artist. Tilt brush is a program from Google where you can essentially draw in virtual reality in 3D. She is going to be recreating every single piece of the ingredients and the process in virtual reality. Hmm. And we're going to turn that into essentially a 360 video, so you can see the piece literally being drawn in front of you, and the you're essentially watching, like, there's one part of a dish where the eggs are, they're marbled eggs, but they're actually pickled, and I'm talking about the symbolism behind that and why, like, you know, it's a fight between using what you know, but how do you be authentic, like, how can you appropriate your own culture, sort of thing, walking through that, so watching that scene unfold in front of you in virtuality as I'm narrating it. And then after you watch each dish be composed, you take off your headset and the dish is in front of you, so it's like kind of a nice, like, yeah, eating with the headset on is no fun, so yeah, it's kind of like a nice 360 of the dish from start to finish.
Okay, yeah, I was gonna ask if you eat while all that's so much happening.
No. It's just like too much, right. Yeah.
Did you try that in the first iteration? Like, if you know, actually consume the item as you were learning about it, how does that affect your experience of it?
In VR specifically, you just can't see in front of you. Oh. So like you, I think I might experiment with people drinking while they are in the headset, because I think that's a little bit more feasible, but I think, or like maybe through a sippy straw, but I think eating is just not like, I don't know where the food would end up. And also part of it is I want you to see the food. Mm-hmm. So then that kind of defeats the purpose. We did this VR plus food event in Nicaragua where we had people on and off with the headsets and eating. And we learned a lot from that, and just people are a little bit uncomfortable. So how do you get them to feel like the movements are more fluid and feel like the headset is not like just this giant obstacle in the way, but like they're enjoying the experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So little things, I'm still definitely figuring that out too.
Mm-hmm. And so you've just done the VR/AR with the Asian American series?
So we did one in Nicaragua. It was sponsored by a hotel. So essentially Nicaragua has always kind of played second fiddle to Costa Rica. And now they're trying to really reestablish themselves and get their word out there. And so this particular hotel collection, they have eco luxury hotels, they've coined them as. And we went and we profiled three different parts of like Nicaraguan food culture with 360 videos. So one of them, for instance, is coffee. We don't, as Americans, we drink a ton of Nicaraguan coffee, like a lot of the high quality coffee that comes into our countries from Nicaragua, but we don't really know anything about it or what the process looks like. So in our tasting event, the last course was coffee. So you would put on the headset, you would watch the whole process of coffee from, you know, them being shade grown, what does that mean, to the workers picking it off and dumping in the truck. I mean, these workers, they're working day round. Like when they're drying these beans, they have to bring them from the facility, they're fermented and they're getting dried, and every one of them is carrying 120 pounds of beans on their back, and you can see them like running across this huge like football field size thing and dumping these beans. And anyway, so it's like that's a whole process, you watch that unfold. And then I made like a coffee dessert. My husband did a coffee-based cocktail. We also studied fish, and then we did this one called Caballo Bio, which is kind of like a Nicaraguan feast and like the history of that and stuff. So it was nice because most of our clientele was Nicaraguan, and they were like, oh, it's just nice to see our own stuff like done in a way where it's respectful and like this is like feeling like this is cool. So yeah, that was a really good experience. I mean, that was very low budget as far as things go. We were in the middle of Nicaragua. Wi-Fi was kind of shaky. So, you know, picture quality wasn't fantastic because we were on the lowest video resolution. But still, I feel like watching it make an impact, I'm like, oh, this is cool. Like, there's something here that I should unpack. So the Asian and America one is my next one. And then I'm working on one with a choreographer called Hidden, where it's going to be like VR plus dancing plus immersive theater with food to uncover kind of like the hidden parts about ourselves.
Okay. This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back after a short break.
You're visiting the in-laws this weekend. They've asked you to bring wine. You need a bottle that says, I'm laid back enough that I didn't think about this choice for hours. But also, I've graduated from Two Buck Chuck, proving I can provide for your daughter and our future children. where to go from here? Just ask Vivino. Vivino knows feeling pressured in the wine aisle can sour the whole experience. But with the largest wine inventory, Vivino gives you the best price on personalized picks based on your taste profile, then ships them right to your door. Scan wines, compare reviews, save your favorites, and even get unlimited free shipping with Vivino Premium, plus a free 30-day trial. So, when that next visit rolls around, you know exactly what that dry Alsatian Riesling says about your commitment to your mother-in-law's Sunday roast. Visit vivino.com/heritage to stock up. Vivino, wine made easy.
And we're back. This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm speaking with chef slash fellow radio host Jenny Dorsey about her recent trip and project in Nicaragua. So let's actually talk about that dinner you did there. You were talking about how the diners were primarily Nicaraguan. Mm-hmm. Was that, did you know that was going to be the case? Like, how would you have cooked the dinner differently maybe if they were all tourists?
Yeah, so we weren't completely sure who our audience was going to be. So it was sponsored by a hotel, as I mentioned. So the dinner happened at the hotel, and all the staff were invited, all the guests were invited, and then there were some people from the Tourism Board of Nicaragua there. And we actually thought it would be a lot more guests who came, so tourists, mm-hmm. But not a lot of guests came, because I think presumably they were doing like some activity, you know, so they just weren't at like the hotel. Mm-hmm. And so what ended up happening was like a lot of the staff came, which was great because I had been working with, you know, the kitchen staff pretty closely all week to test and experiment all these dishes. And a lot of times they've been eating like parcels of things that I've been making, but like they would be like, this tastes good, I guess. I don't know what this is, you know? And so for them to kind of see it all together, I think was really rewarding. Right. For like, also because like they were literally, we wouldn't have been able to do anything without them. They had to, there was one particular memory I have where I made this ceviche, because we talked about fish. Nicaragua is situated in an interesting location where it has access to Pacific fish, Gulf of the Caribbean fish, and they also have this giant lake called Lake Nicaragua, which we were at, that has lake fish. And so they have all these varieties, and just kind of like talking about all these different fish that they have. I made the ceviche. The ceviche that they have in Nicaragua is kind of what you imagine as the classic kind of like Peruvian ceviche, I guess, as Peru has made it very popular, but like lime juice, onions, maybe some fried plantains, relatively simple. I did a more of like a Filipino style ceviche because it's actually a very similar tropical climate, and was kind of like just talking to them about how like Filipinos make the ceviche, and they were like, oh wait, we need coconuts for this, and literally go to the back and like opened up a coconut for us. I was like, oh my god, peligroso, you know. But and just like being able to like just share a little bit about that, I'm not Filipino, but being able to like, hey, like this is an interesting thought, like, but they do all these other things with coconut milk that Filipinos don't do, like being able to appreciate, I don't know, it was just an interesting like conversation about cuisines around the world, and they see it in a very different way that we do because they don't have to deal with as much appropriation as we do. But yeah, overall, I think it was very rewarding for them to be able to see all the pieces come together.
Mm-hmm. But like Devil Jenny on your shoulder, were you ever thinking about like, oh my gosh, this is a lot of responsibility, right? I am the one to introduce this Filipino dish and culture.
Yes.
And I'm more so referencing your recent post on substitutions and how it's not it's not culture's responsibility to make themselves accessible to people that are foreign with it, right?
Yes, yes.
And so how did you mitigate that? You know, I know it's easy to just be like, oh, well, we're all just coming here to eat good food.
No,
and like,
but it's not though. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think one of the big things that I kept worrying about all week when I was there was like, I'm coming here, some like random person from the States, taking like all these staples of Nicaragua and reimagining it into a meal. Like, who am I? What kind of like entitled person am I, you know? And I was really worried that they would be like, ugh, who's this person? And one of the things that really struck me was the kitchen crew was so welcoming. They were like, this is how we do it here. This is how we like it. You know, this is how we prepare the tripe for mondongo. Like, And they were so generous. And when I was like, oh, I think I'm going to do this with it. Is that cool? Mm-hmm. Please say it's cool. It's okay. And they were like, yeah, that's so awesome. And when I made, so they have a lot of papayas. And then when you take papaya seeds and grind them, it kind of tastes like black pepper. Mm-hmm. So I did like cashew and pepe, but with papaya seeds, and they were all like, oh, we never eat pasta, we love it. And there was like this one cheese farm that we went to that makes cheese, because this, like, Nicaraguans eat a specific kind of cheese more frequently than other types of cheeses, but they produce more French cheeses. So anyway, it was this like weird, like, not really cacio and pepe, but kind of in that style. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to find the words of like, This is kind of what I was going for. This is not what it always tastes like, but I kind of incorporated little bits of this to that to it, and they were so enthusiastic. And I think that's what I mean when they see appropriation differently, because they don't have all these different cultures mingling the way we do, that they don't see it as offensive if I take a little bit of this and a little bit of that and mix it. Whereas I don't know if that would be seen the same way here, and I'm cognizant of that, and I don't know, I have feelings about that as well. But overall, I think they were pretty open to it. Like, thankfully, they were very happy and supportive of the project. And more so, they were just happy to see these videos that showed how hard they were working and how much they cared about their coffee and all these, like, quality inspections that they put on the coffee or the fish and et cetera. And to shine light on some of the issues, like, for instance, we don't know any Nicaraguan producers of coffee, because those high-quality coffee beans come here green, and then a roaster puts their name on it. Mm-hmm. So we know Stumptown, we know whatever, but right. We don't know the people who are, like, working their butts off, like, fermenting this coffee. Same thing with chocolate, but that's a different story. And with fish, Nicaraguans have so much access to all these amazing fish, but most of that, like, the more prized fish is all immediately taken and sold into the States. So, like, they have tons of mahi-mahi there, but Nicaraguans don't eat mahi-mahi because Americans buy it from them. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a real thing. And so being able to, I guess, wrestle with that a little bit, I thought was important, and I think they appreciated that.
Have you thought of, because I'm guessing you still have all that VR footage and mm-hmm. those recipes, have you ever thought of kind of recontextualizing it for an American audience here in New York City?
So we're doing a little demo, I guess a mini demo, in a week on the 17th at this VR studio called Little Star. It's kind of like an art VR AR showcase where I'll be showing the coffee video and then doing a little sample of the coffee dessert and the coffee cocktail. And so, yeah, that will be interesting to see how it's understood there. I think the narration of the video itself is relatively, it's not like accusatory. It's just like, this is what's happening. And then being able to paint a little bit more context, like just like what I told you about the fact that we don't know any producers down in Nicaragua because their name never gets shown, their light never gets shown on their name. Being able to have that kind of conversation, maybe one-on-one with people, would have more impact than pushing it out and making it feel like a prescriptive message. I don't know. I feel like people turn off when you try to tell them stuff like that, because there's such a cognitive dissonance. They don't want to believe that they've been part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. I think even if we admit we're part of the problem, it's really hard to see the change through. Because, you know, living in Brooklyn, we have access to so many of these, like, quote-unquote hip coffee shops that are selling these single-origin, fair trade, blah, blah, blah coffees. And we're like, okay, this came from this village in this country. But then what do we do with that information?
Yeah.
Like, how do we move forward with that?
Are we going to go source, like, our new coffees? Yeah. Like,
we're growing in our backyard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so tough questions that we can't quite answer yet.
It's like, how, I think we were talking about this before the show, but I think the big thing is, like, how do we find the balance of being able to step aside ourselves and letting other people speak? And for brands, especially for brands who are really taking other people's products, mm-hmm. like, how do you let the producer really shine through? but still make money, because you have to make money because you're a business.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually just going to quote you from an Instagram. This is so future, okay. But I thought this was so beautifully written. Is you say, a few years of immersion is not the same as living and breathing the culture for a lifetime. Too often we only listen to minorities as an echo to a privileged chef leading the charge, which diminishes the nuances of the cuisine only their voices can offer. So can you talk a bit about these kind of gaps in our culinary landscape and even just New York City or Brooklyn, and what are the dangers of cooking an inspired dish versus just letting the person who is familiar and has grown up with these dishes cook that dish?
Yeah, I want to reference a meme video thing that I think is now relevant to this. Is there's a video clip of Gordon Ramsay cooking pad thai. Have you seen this?
No.
So Gordon Ramsay is, I'm not sure where, but he's like next to this Thai chef. So I think they're in Thailand. Not sure. So anyway, he cooks his pad thai and this Thai chef tastes it. And Gordon Ramsay literally is like, this is pretty good, right? And the Thai chef's like, this is not pad thai.
Wait, on TV?
On TV. It's a video. I'm sure
on Food Network?
I don't think so. Okay. I don't know what.
How did it go?
I have no idea, but it's gone like viral because it's hilarious. And also Gordon Ramsay's always the one yelling at people.
Right.
And I think that's funny, right? Because, I mean, it's funny because it's, you know, Gordon Ramsay getting yelled at. But also the fact that Gordon Ramsay is so sure that he knows what pad thai is, right? That it's like, you can see on his face, he's so confused, he's so shocked, he doesn't know, his world turned upside down, because this chef is like, no, that's not right. Because everything, maybe it's not Gordon's fault. All his teachers have taught him this. All his TV producers who've taught him pad thai have told him all these things that are inaccurate, because we don't give enough representation to Thai chefs, Thai people, to tell us what their food is supposed to taste like. Yeah. I remember going to culinary school, and the way we even talk and represent and teach the new generation of chefs about cuisine, global cuisine, is so bad. For instance, we spend a month wandering around France talking about the terroir of Normandy, and like, if cows on one side of the Rhone like taste like this and cows on the other side taste like this, like, and then we go to China and we're there for 2 days and there's the cuisine differences we just forget about. Forget Japan. We didn't even touch Southeast Asia. Like, I think we made a vermicelli dish and called it Vietnamese. I mean, this is embarrassing. This is like a what's now known as a very good culinary school. And so how can you, it's almost like, are those chefs, these new chefs, to blame because they have no idea? And then they can go pull yuzu from Japanese cuisine and now they're like, oh, I make Japanese food and it's really great. And they have no idea what they're talking about. It's like this whole trickle down system of bad information and bias and cultural like stereotypes being passed down.
Mm-hmm. No. So I met this, I think he's a Vietnamese chef in Brooklyn. He's white. And his whole thing was like, he came up to me and was like, oh, I love your show. It teaches me how to think about what I cook. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, that's really interesting. What do you cook? And he says like, oh, I just like really love the flavors of Vietnam. And I've been really inspired by that, mm-hmm. which is like, yes, on paper, that's really awesome. And beautiful that you are exploring this culture that you're not familiar with, but why that's still so problematic, you know, that you are kind of making this like a spectacle or like some kind of hobby of yours. And but then it makes me think like he might be one of these grads that you're talking about that like only had 30 minutes with Vietnam in a culinary school class. And so how do you advise these people to, you know, tread these waters sensibly and sensitively?
I think the first thing that you can really, all you can really do is like, we can't change what people want to cook, but we can reinforce and demand from these chefs and purveyors and whatnot to be more honest with what they do and what more especially what they don't know. I think that's where I was also having went back to Nicaragua, was being able to like, now that I've come home and I'm like, oh, I went to Nicaragua and did this tasting, I'm like, I don't know anything about Nicaraguan food. I know little bits of it now. I was able to talk to one of their chefs and hear about how they make this like particular soup or how they do. Sure, like I can kind of recite that, but that makes me no expert.
Mm-hmm. You're opening a Nicaraguan restaurant.
Right, exactly. The hottest opening is going to be on like Grub Street's power list.
Some like child market hog.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Like, I'm not an expert. I can say that I was inspired by tasting some of these things. I really like some of the flavor profiles. I was really into those papaya seeds and using them as black pepper. And like, that's cool. And I think if more chefs took that approach, is like, I like these things, but I still don't know anything about their culture. And I don't understand the psyche that goes in behind their food as well. I just know, like, the ingredient, and I appreciate that ingredient. I think we can progress a little farther than we have right now. I think right now, a lot of, especially in the food world, there's so much ego, there's so much mania, especially with how media covers food, that people are afraid to admit that they don't know certain things, or they aren't the expert, that they're just also just trying to figure it out too.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to your dog food Asian-American yes. dish, because I'm thinking, like, these dishes are so stunning, and they're clearly indicative of your French training in culinary school, right? Mm-hmm. And all these kitchens, like Atelier Cran. Do you ever feel that kind of disconnect? Like, why do these funky Asian foods have to be presented in a French
yes.
Eurocentric style plating to be approachable?
Yes. So I have a dish called Fancy Because It's French that takes a traditional Chinese mooncake, which I don't know how many people have made traditional Chinese mooncake. I personally have not. I've just watched it.
It's too scary.
It's so stressful. Yeah. Like, it's so hard. Everything, my mom makes it sometimes. It's like weird and lumpy. Sorry, mom. but like, it's just, it's really difficult. But yet, we don't see that as fancy. I recreate this mooncake. There's red bean mousse. There's, you know how usually there's like a salted egg yolk in the middle. I take that and make it into essentially like a creme anglaise. Mm. There's an oolong biscuit, whatever. So it's all very Francais. And now suddenly, like, I can call it an entremet, and it's cool and it's fancy. And like, this is a mid-course dessert, essentially, is how it would be presented in a French setting. And isn't that strange? The fact that I can take something that was already really difficult, re-engineer it, and now finally actually people will be stunned or wowed or want to pay money for this dish. It's unfair and it's baseless. And like, why is that? Maybe we should evaluate all these judgments that we have. Just like how I think we could talk about MSG for days, but MSG has been vilified for decades now for no reason, because it's a more of a cultural perception thing than an ingredient perception thing. And there's so many of those unconscious biases in food that we don't acknowledge. So sorry, to answer your question, yeah, that bothers me. And I want to talk about that. I want people to see that and recognize how extremely, like, just incongruous, like, some of these thoughts are about what cuisine is worthwhile and what cuisine is not.
Mm-hmm. There's also this weird spectrum where fancy food is very petite with like very tiny portions, mm-hmm. and it's just so precious. And then there's like family style Asian food that is just like a lot of it, and it's like, what, quote unquote, ugly delicious. And so, yeah. Do you feel like there is a happy medium, or do you feel like you're gonna have to change the way you plate things or even conceptualize dishes?
Yeah, this is hard for me, because a lot of times the food that I make, I would just like never eat that at home for dinner.
Yeah.
You know, well, first of all, because it would take way too long and I don't have like hours to prepare my own dinner, but also just like, that's not my comfort food for a lot of times. Like, there are things that I make that are my own comfort food, but if I were to serve them, I have to plate them in a different way if I want to command a certain price point.
Right.
There's a funny like sketch online where it's like, depending on how much white space there is on the plate, you know how fancy the restaurant is. And if there's like 80% of the plate is white, like so much wasted space, then you know you have to wear a full suit. But it's kind of true, right?
Yeah.
Like, when I first started making food for Wednesdays, I would make, I think, more like things that I wouldn't make at home, like braised pork belly and over rice or kale salads and stuff. And I don't think I've seen a kale salad on my menu for years now, because people want to see, like, you know, dainty little things. And it's complicated, like, because family style is hard too. Family style has its own thing, and some people gravitate towards that, and their food isn't any less important. So how do we get people to appreciate it? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And this reminds me of this other thing you posted about the statement, less is more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading this book that it's this super angsty guy, but he talks about how like the easier food has gotten to source, the harder we make it on ourselves to get. Like, we want the most organic, we want like to know our farmer, et cetera, et cetera. And there's like also something problematic about that. And so can you talk about that kind of like classicist use of that phrase?
I think it's so indicative of like this income disparity issue that we have going on in our country, and the fact that instead of recognizing we have problems in helping the lowest rung and pulling them up, instead we're like, I think this is, goes through privilege as well. It's like, oh, well, they got themselves there, so they have to kind of deal with it. Mm-hmm. And not we, but we got here to our middle or upper middle or, you know, upper class, like, food establishments and lives because we worked really hard, like, kind of reconciling that privilege. And I think with food, we see people who eat not as fancy food as we do, and we're like, oh, well, they're not as refined as we are, and we can choose to have to help that farmer in Nicaragua because we're so in the know, and we're so we're able to do so because we care so much, and they don't care, and really they don't have the content, like they don't have the time and the space and the energy and the money to care. Right. They have so many other things to worry about. They can't, when they want to take their friends out to a fancy meal, they can't afford to go to this restaurant, and we're judging them for it. And why is that? Like, food is supposed to be more egalitarian. Food is supposed to help us bridge these cultures, but instead we're using it as a way to promote our social status. I don't know. There's so much there that it upsets me, and at the same time, sometimes I feel like I'm part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. And so we've talked about race, economic classes, but last but not least, I want to talk about your experience on Chopped. So I've never met anyone that's been on Chopped.
Sure.
So can you? I read your piece in Girl Boss, which I thought was really incredible and made me cry, actually, because there's this part where you talk about, like, oh, you failed, you got chopped, blah, 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 you're sad, and your, like, husband goes in for the hug, and you're just like, I don't deserve this hug. And mm-hmm. I think that's something a lot of Asian Americans really can relate to and identify with. And can you, like, talk about how responding to failure is much more than just, like, getting back on the horse after you've fallen off of it? Like, it's really hard, and what it means for you.
I think it's, like, this inner self-worth that I think a lot of Asian Americans struggle with, because, well, I don't want to generalize to everyone's parents, but I think as many of our cultures, our families don't really know how to show that they love us no matter what the outcomes of what we do are. It's like, it's as if what we are able to achieve taints who we are inside. So if we don't achieve something, then that means we're like innately bad or worthless. Mm-hmm. And then you carry that around forever, or go to therapy about it, hopefully. And I think that's what I was struggling with after Chopped, was like, oh, well, if I was Chopped first, then I must be a bad chef, you know? Yeah. And Chopped just showed that, but I was a bad chef this whole time. It's not, my husband has grown up in a really loving family, and his perception is like, oh, it didn't work out for me today. But I can never see it that way. Mm-hmm. And it's a pity that that's how my family raised me. But at the same time, being able to recognize that and try to reshape I thought about failure, as like, instead of failure had to do with me, failure had to do with the context that I was in and how I performed that day. And it was like a step in my life. It was like this milestone that I could push beyond. But I don't think that was I don't think I've gotten over it. It's not a perfect process. I sometimes still wake up in the middle of the night and I'm like, oh my God, if I had just done that day, that I would have done better. I can't believe it. Like, I suck at everything. There's so many moments of like imposter syndrome and insecurity that I go through on a day-to-day basis that I don't think that cycle will ever really be complete. I can just hope that I will not pass that like self-worth problem down to my kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you talked about how right after you got back from the Chelsea Market Food Network kitchen, and you went and bought some crabs to like fix the problem, which is something I totally would have done.
If I could just do it more, I'll fix it.
Right, yeah. And you perfect it, and you like made them amazing at home, but it like doesn't make you feel better.
You can never. Yeah, it's like, there's this like hole in your heart, I think, that we're also always trying to fill with more stuff. And I especially felt this way when I was in fashion, but even still, sometimes it's like, if I can publish that piece, if I can do this, if I can get this press hit, if I can make more money, there's always something that that's missing. And that's because there's something in me that makes me feel like I'm not whole. I'm not good enough just as I am. I need more things. And that's a problem.
Yeah. But I think I think there's a lot of worth to just recognizing that. Like, as much as I want this episode to end on like and you should feel this way about yourself, it's kind of like, nope, that's it.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to keep dealing with it.
Yeah, that's life, right?
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me today, Jenny. This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coralie.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.